We're in chapter 13. No, we're not. We finished chapter 13. What was chapter 13 about? Oh my word. Chaotic murmuring, silence. Okay, what was it about? And it resumes. No, anyway. Parables. There, I heard one word legibly. Yes.
Kingdom.
Yes,
parables.
Kingdom parables. How many parables were there? Yes.
Seven.
Six plus one. Yes, seven. Seven, exactly. What was the first one?
The
parable of the sowers. And what did the parable of the sowers emphasize?
People hearing the kingdom.
Yes, the reception of the kingdom message or the rejection. How people are hearing the message, how they are accepting it, interacting with it. In the other six, they hammered on actually three different concepts. Can we name all three of them? Because remember, you have the first one that was hammering one, then these two kind of said the same thing, then another one, then these two said the same thing, then another one.
Victory,
yes. Victory comes at the beginning, middle, and end, right? Yes, what are the other two? The program and the worth, exactly. But remember, the concept of victory is very important because the victory that it is emphasizing at the beginning, middle, and end is trying to emphasize the concept that even in the face of evil, even in the face of evil, the kingdom of God is victorious. And that's going to be really important because of what we're going to be seeing over the next several chapters. Right after those kingdom parables, you have Jesus that is dishonored even in his own hometown of Nazareth. And yet, even in the face of evil, even in the face of rejection, the kingdom is victorious. That John will be killed in the first 12 verses that we're going to be dealing with now. And people hearing that type of message, whenever the key herald of the kingdom, the initial herald of the kingdom, is killed, it may make them think, it may make their faith shake as far as the effectiveness of the kingdom. But the parables tell us that even in the face of evil, the kingdom is victorious. Then what we're going to see is we're going to have the kingdom in the wilderness in chapter 14, 13 through 21, and they're without food. And yet what we will see is that even in the face of persecution or evil or of hard times, the kingdom is victorious. And ultimately, we're going to see the disciples faced with a storm that is not in this sense figurative, but literal. But even in the face of that chaos and evil, the kingdom is victorious. So the message of the seven parables is going to be ringing throughout the next couple of chapters, especially because we're building up to chapter 16 and 17 whenever Jesus very clearly articulates what is going to happen to him. That the leader of the kingdom, of our movement, of this people, will be killed. But even in the face of evil, the kingdom will be victorious. Do you see what's happening? The third major discourse, chapter 13, is setting us up for the rest of what's about to happen. And ultimately, that's going to be a message we're going to need to hear. Jesus and John, Jesus is the one that is first rejected in chapter 13, 53 through 58. But his rejection is right next to John's rejection in chapter 14, 1 through 12. And the reason why is because, in some sense, both of them are being rejected for the same reasons. And ultimately, this will foreshadow both of them paralleling each other because of their fate. Because both of them will face death at the hands of the other kingdoms for reasons that can't be clearly articulated, even by the person killing them themselves. Does that make sense? Their ministries have been paralleled so far. What they've been speaking have been paralleled so far. And what we see is that both of them will be rejected, and that both of them will ultimately lead to their death because of the ministry and because of the message they've been preaching. But the parables tell us that even in the face of chaos and evil, the kingdom of God is victorious. I'm going to say that probably 50 times today. But that's something that if you walked out in the rest of the weekend, it was ringing in your ears, it wouldn't be a bad thing. You know? Is that right, John Michael? Sound good to you? Sounds good to me too. He was the only one nodding, that's why I picked him out. He wasn't sleeping. Okay. Chapter 14, verse 1. At that time, Herod the Tetrarch heard the reports about Jesus. Which Herod is this? Good answer. Let's be more specific. Beyond the text, what Herod is this? Herod Antipas. Exactly right, exactly right, exactly right. How do we know this is Herod Antipas? What's that? Herod the Great did die. And who was Herod Antipas in relation to Herod the Great? Herod the Great dies in March 4 BC. What's that? He was his what? Son. Exactly right. He was his son. When Herod the Great died, what happened to his kingdom? It was split up amongst his three sons. You had Herod Archelaus, Herod Antipas, and Herod Philip II. So if you call their home, just ask for Herod. Archelaus was 19 years old whenever he became king. This is information we've gone over before, and I'm re-going over it because it's been about 10 chapters, or 12. Archelaus was 19 years old, and he became the king over Judea, Samaria, and Idumea. Where else have we seen Herod Archelaus? His name has appeared in the Gospel of Matthew. Chapter 2. Exactly right. And what role did he play in chapter 2? Say it again. Yes, in the key areas of Judea, where what city would have rested was he the ruler over?
Bethlehem.
Exactly. And where was Jesus and his family? Egypt. And they were going to be coming back to Bethlehem, but an angel told them not to go because Archelaus was ruling. So they ended up landing in Nazareth. Archelaus was evil, and that's the reason why he only reigned for 9 years. And then finally Rome was like, this dude is crazy. They got rid of him, and Rome decided we are going to rule from now on. So they start putting their prefects, their procurators, ruling over the region of Judea, Samaria, and Idumea. Herod Antipas was 17 years old when he became king. Let that one sink in for a second. So you would have already been a king of your land had you been Herod Antipas. He was the king over Galilee and Perea. He reigned for 43 years. In the eyes of Rome, he wasn't that bad of a king. We will see Herod Antipas a couple of times in the ministry of Jesus. The only other time that we see Herod Antipas is actually outside of this one right here in Matthew 14, is actually outside of the book of Matthew. It's in Luke 23, and do you know what significant event Herod Antipas takes part in eventually in the life of Jesus? His trials. Exactly. He's one of the ones that Jesus goes before in trials. Finally, the other son was Herod Philip II, or Philip the Tetrarch. He inherited the region of Bithynia in the northeast region. We'll actually be talking about that in 3 chapters. So just remember Philip II. His capital was Caesarea Philippi. That'll become significant later. But right here we have Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas. Now here's the question. How did Herod Antipas hear the reports about Jesus? Because that's moving up the trail. This all of a sudden isn't just some random little small movement that's occurring. How has he heard the reports? Say that again. Maybe that is what it is. Maybe he's overhearing the disciples of John speaking to John from chapter 11. Good observation. What else?
Could have been Jesus' disciples. He sent them out.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe whenever in chapter 10, when Jesus sends out his disciples, maybe Herod... Remember Herod the Great? We talked about before how that guy had spies everywhere. And maybe Herod Antipas, his son, has taken a page out of his political book. Another reason is that Sepphoris, which was Herod Antipas' capital... Oh, no, wait a minute. I'm sorry, not Sepphoris. Tiberias. Good grief. Sepphoris was a city that was about 10 miles away from Nazareth. But Tiberias is a city that was 8.5 miles down the coast of the Sea of Galilee from Capernaum. That makes sense? What is significant about Capernaum? Yes, it's his home base of operations, exactly. So only 8.5 miles away, Jesus is doing some stuff that's going to be causing some stirrings. A matter of fact, also the fact the connection with John the Baptist, I'd also agree with what Kayla said, is that there's probably some interaction with John the Baptist and Herod Antipas, since John the Baptist was the one heralding Jesus coming. So, he hears the reports. Let's keep reading. And he said to his attendants, "This is John the Baptist. He has risen from the dead." If you're reading Matthew for the very first time, what has just shocked you about that verse? Yeah, John's dead? Where have we seen John the Baptist? There's 2 times that we've seen John the Baptist so far in Matthew. Where have we seen him? Actually, 3 times. We know 3 key points about John the Baptist. Where's the first time we see him? chapter 3. And where is he at and what is he doing?
Desert.
He's in the desert and he's proclaiming the kingdom of God is here. Where is the second time that we see John the Baptist's name pop up? Chapter 4, that's exactly right. And what information do we have there? He's arrested. He's put into prison, which launches what? Jesus' ministry to Galilee. Where is the third time we see John the Baptist's name in the Gospel of Matthew? Chapter 11, which what happens there? John the Baptist is questioning, sending his disciples, questioning whether or not Jesus is even the Messiah. So that's all we have of John so far. And all of a sudden now he's like, he's back from the dead. And you're thinking, when did he die? I'm glad you asked. Because that's what dominates the rest of the verses of the first 12 verses of 14. That is why miraculous powers are at work in him, Herod says. Verse 3, now Herod had arrested John and bound him and put him in prison because of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife. Oh, we have to talk about this. This really, really, really weird and strange family bush. It's not a tree because the branches don't go that far out in the Herod the Great family. Herod Antipas married Herodias, who the text tells us was his brother Philip. Remember Philip? The one that is the king over Bethania up in the northeast region. It was Philip's wife. How did this all happen? Well, initially Herod Antipas was married to the daughter of King Aretas IV. More than likely this was a politically arranged marriage by Augustus because it would bring peace to the whole region if Herod Antipas was married to this princess. They were married for 15 years until Herod Antipas fell in love with Herodias. And yes, he ended up stealing her away. But what makes this a little more disgusting is that Herodias was already the half-niece of Herod Philip I and Herod Antipas. So Uncle Herod Antipas, who happens also to be Herodias' brother-in-law, decides to marry Herodias by stealing the wife away from his brother. Oh, it gets even more disgusting. Let's keep reading. Do I want to keep reading? Oh, I will say this. This actually does cause problems for Herod Antipas later on in his political career. Because in AD 36, King Aretas IV, whose daughter was initially married to Herod Antipas, comes basically for revenge against Herod Antipas and just decimates Herod Antipas' army in AD 36. So, this will come back to haunt him again later. Hey-o, little joke, pun intended. Never mind. Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, for John had been saying to him, it is not lawful for you to have her. Here is the question I want to ask you, scholars, exegetes of Matthew. Was John's accusation against Herod simply a spiritual matter? And if you give me an answer, tell me why you're giving me that answer. Was it just a spiritual matter? Because if it is, we'll just keep moving. Was this accusation in verse 4, it is not lawful for you to have her. It is not lawful for Herod Antipas to have Herodias. Is that just a spiritual issue? Is that why John the Baptist is arrested and put into prison? Because over a disagreement of spiritual realities. I'm seeing head shaking no, but I want somebody to vocalize, if it is no, why? What is it then? What is this type of accusation? Any guesses? Yeah.
Would this be a political thing, like between Rome and the person who's supposed to be ruling over Roman province?
Ooh, that's a good point. I mean, my word, Rome has put Herod Antipas in power, right? And if he's coming at him and critiquing him, that could put him in some sort of conflict with Rome itself. Could. Although, nor more than likely the way Rome handles things, they don't just throw people in prison, they'll just kill them. But, you know, sometimes they're benevolent, put them in prison. But what else? I think that as part of this.
Well, his brother's not dead, so he literally stole his brother's wife.
Mm-hmm.
There's no record for us of any divorce or anything there even. So, that's
Okay, so let's ask this question then. Unlawful for who?
The Jews.
For the Jews. Now, what political impact does that have if Herod Antipas is not following the laws of the Jews? What does Herod Antipas claim to be? King of the Jews. Just like those Hasmoneans. What was their problem? Well, they weren't lawful either, were they? What are the Jews looking for? For their true king to come and reign, right? And by their definition, this has been the issue so far all the whole time with Jesus and with the teachers of the law and the Pharisees, is they don't think Jesus is acting lawful. Therefore, by extension, they don't think that he can be their true and rightful king, do they? You see, John the Baptist is not just making a spiritual statement. He's making a political one. He is saying, you are not fit to rule us. You are not the king that is to reign. You are not the king of Israel. You can't be. Why? Because you do what is unlawful. And the king is supposed to come and to bring purity back to the exiles. You see what's happening? It's not just a spiritual issue. Is it one? Yeah, it's spiritual. But it is very political. Because he is saying that the one in which Rome has put over them is not the real king. He's having some issues with both kingdoms. You see what's happening? Does that make sense? Nod or holler if you hear me. Okay, good. Just making sure we're all awake here this morning. Good, good, good. All right. Verse 5. Herod wanted to kill John. He wanted to kill John, but was afraid of the people because they considered him a prophet. Notice that right there. Remember what we've heard of, something that was alluded to Herod Antipas in chapter 11? I showed you on a coin. What was it? Did you come out to the desert to see the reed swayed by the wind? You see that? What's happening here? Verse 5. It's showing us which way the wind is blowing and which way the reed, Herod Antipas, is leaning. He wants to kill John, but he won't. Why? Because of the crowds. Got to keep peace. That is way more important than personal vendettas in the Roman world. Because if you don't keep peace, well, Herod Antipas knows from his brother Archelaus what happens. You get removed. Okay. On Herod's birthday, oh great, here comes more disgustingness. The daughter of Herodias danced for them and pleased Herod so much that he promised with an oath to give her whatever she asked. The daughter would not have been Herod Antipas' daughter. It would have been Philip's daughter. So it would have been Herod's niece from his brother and half-niece. Okay. She would have been about 12 to 14 years old because of the word that's used to describe her. And the pleasingness of Herod in this situation means that her dance was probably very sensual and it brought him sexual pleasure. And that's why he promises his niece, which is the daughter of his half-niece, old Uncle Antipas promises her whatever she wants. Makes an oath. Have we talked about oaths in Matthew yet? Yes. What chapter? Yes. Sermon on the Mount. Sermon on the Mount. Okay. Okay, yes, yes, yes. Whatever she asked. Prompted by her mother, she said, "Give me here on a platter the head of John the Baptist." The king was distressed, but because of his oaths and his dinner guests, he ordered that her request be granted and had John beheaded in the prison. Here's the problem for Herod Antipas. He has a political problem because if he kills John the Baptist, it could cause major, major problems in the region because John the Baptist had such a gathering, such a crowd, and his message and his crowd were gathered in the desert, all political, revolutionary, explosive things. So if he just lops off the head of John the Baptist, it could cause major issues. However, there is a greater law at play here because in their society, honor and shame is what ruled the day. He has made an oath, a public oath, to give his niece whatever she wants. And if he does not deliver on this oath, he will experience great shame, which is worse than even losing his political power. You see that? He's driven by honor. Whatever it takes to secure or to gain more honor, he will do, even if it means potentially causing political problems. So that's what he does. King is distressed. Verse 11, his head was brought in on a platter and given to the girl. My word. I mean, what does that do to a 12-year-old? Here's your head, daughter. You know, I mean, goodness gracious. Then again, never mind. Who carried it to her mother? John's disciples came and took his body and buried it. Then they went and told Jesus. Verse 13. When Jesus heard what had happened, he withdrew by boat privately to a solitary place. Okay, first time something happened in the ministry of John the Baptist was in chapter 4, verse 12, whenever John was put into prison. And what did that launch? Jesus' Galilean ministry. Here at the death of John, we are going to start to see the ship begin to turn. For in the next two chapters, the Galilean ministry is going to start coming to a conclusion. And in chapter 16, verse 21, we have the actual shift to Jerusalem. But what you're going to see is in chapter 15, you're going to see teachers of the law coming from Jerusalem. In chapter 15, verse 21, we're going to see Jesus starting to deal with Gentiles, with the Canaanite woman. You're going to see him start feeding 4,000, which has Gentile undertones. And then you're ultimately going to see in chapter 16, Jesus finally do an about face and say, I'm heading to Jerusalem. So this is the moment, another moment in John the Baptist's life starts to begin, becomes a key marker for the ministry of Jesus in Matthew. So he retreats to a solitary place, a desert-like place, a place of isolation. Catch the political undertones there, they're going to come up in a minute. Hearing of this, the crowds followed him on foot from the towns. When Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them and healed their sick. As evening approached, the disciples came to him and said, "This is a remote place, an isolated place, a solitary place, a desert-like place. And it's already getting late. Send the crowds away so they can go to the villages and buy themselves some food." Jesus replied, "They do not need to go away. You give them something to eat." We have here only 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish, they answered. "Bring them here to me," he said, and he directed the people to sit down on the grass. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, and looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke the loaves. Okay, stop right there. In the last, what is it? From verses 17 to 19, we have something that's emphasized keyly twice. What is it? 5 loaves and 2 fish. Why would that be significant?
7.
See what's adding up here? Do you think Matthew will repeat? Matter of fact, we're going to see this. We're going to see this in both the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000. The numbers that emerge are very important. They're constantly reiterated. Matter of fact, Jesus will even point back to the numbers later on. He'll say, "How many basketfuls did you pick up at the feeding of the 5,000? What about the feeding of the 4? The numbers in this text are very important. How many pieces of food or items of food does he have to feed them with?
7.
And is that enough? Yes, because what does the number 7 point to? Completeness. What is the equation whenever you're taking 5 and 2, adding them together for 7, what is the key element that you have to have? Complete reliance on God. We're pointing back to the Sermon on the Mount again. We're pointing back to chapter 10 again. It's going to be something that's very important because in the face of evil, in the face of chaos, the kingdom of God is victorious. And yet whenever you're in the face of evil and chaos, the only thing that you can rely on is numbers like 7. Whenever the equation adds up to God moving. Because the kingdom cannot be victorious if God doesn't move. His commission to them to feed the 5,000 cannot be completed if God is not in the equation. So he has 7 items. He brings them there, he gives thanks, breaks the loaves. Then he gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the people. They all ate and were satisfied, and the disciples picked up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. Help me with the number 12. What? Tribes of Israel. What else? That's exactly right. It can mean 2 things. It can be pointing to the tribes of Israel. It can be pointing to the 12 disciples. Actually, three things. 12 disciples or the number of completion. You guys are thinking, how many numbers of completion are there? There's a lot. But usually the number 12, completion, also is attached to some sort of people-oriented concept. Usually the number 7 is actually can be attached to whatever it wants. But you're really dealing more a lot of the times with some sort of sovereignty language. Or some sort of, we'll even just say, I'm going to say this tentatively. Because, no, I can't say divine. I will say, will I say supernatural? Not the movie, or not the show. I think, I'm trying to think, I'll have to reflect on this more, but I know there's 7 horns on the lamb in Revelation. There's also, let's see, there's 10 horns on the beast, but I think there's also 7 eyes. I'll have to wrestle with whether or not this is true. But the number 4 does mean completion as well, but it is usually attached to something regarding the earth. So you have multiple numbers that are pointing to the concept of completion, but usually they have their own distinct nuance. Is that making sense? So, he provides 7 items, complete sovereignty, the provision of God. And it ultimately provides 12 basketfuls, completeness, which points to the people. Now, let me ask you this question. Is there an Exodus motif that is occurring here?
Yes.
What?
Manna.
Manna. Exactly right. The nation of Israel, once they are experiencing their Exodus, in the face of all chaos and evil, in the face of dire circumstances where they could possibly be starving in the wanderings of the wilderness, all of a sudden, bread from heaven starts to appear. God provides for them through manna, through bread from heaven. And also, similarly, we are in some sort of isolated wandering position where these people come together in a desert-like place, a solitary place, an isolated place. And in this place where they are too far away, in a sense, Jesus in the next chapter, when he's talking about the feeding of the 4,000, he's worried that they won't even be able to make it to the villages before they collapse. He feeds them with bread from heaven. Ultimately, what is this saying then? That just like in Exodus, even in the face of odds that just don't seem to add up, when you add God to the equation, in the face of evil, the kingdom of God is victorious.
Compare that my next study to, like, is it significant that in Exodus, if they collected any extra bread, any extra manna, that it all molded and got eaten by maggots, but in this one they collected 12 baskets full?
Yeah, I could buy that. Yeah, is that we're not just dealing with a one-to-one correlation, it's a how much more situation. Absolutely, I could buy that. All right. Now comes another number. Notice this, at this point in this particular section, numbers have played a prominent role. Yes? As a matter of fact, I'm wrestling with this idea, and maybe some of you that have done inductive studies on something similar to this can help me. I am wondering at this point in Matthew if I can think of a number that I don't think has some sort of symbolic referent to it. Everyone I've come in contact with so far, I think there is some sort of bigger reality going on there than just reporting a number. And even here, this next one. The number of those who ate was about 5,000 men besides women and children. What could that possibly be some sort of symbolic referent to? Any ideas? Say it again. Maybe, yeah, maybe you have a completion of God, the 5, and then you add the 1,000, possibly, all the, yeah. Here's what I'm playing with. If you were a Roman legion, you would have 4,000 to 6,000 troops inside of your particular legion. And here in the wilderness, where revolutions usually begin, Jesus assembles his own legion. But if you're counting the Roman legions, you would not be counting their families. You'd be counting the soldiers, the ones that are actually going out to war. And what do we have here? The number of those who ate was about 5,000 men besides women and children. So in other words, if he was trying to describe the magnitude of the people, why wouldn't he count all of them? I mean, it could be upwards of around 15,000 if there is a one woman for every man and they had maybe one child. I mean, wouldn't that be much more impressive? He fed 15,000 people, but instead he opts for the number 5,000, and you have to ask the question why. Even in a bit, whenever he opts for the number 4,000, we're still dealing with legionary numbers. 4,000 to 6,000 people assembled. But the significance will be which ones or which ethnicity will they be. That'll be significant once we get to the feeding of the 4,000. Ultimately, though, I think that he's saying something political there, because every other number in that section has meant something. Verse 22, immediately Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. After he had, which that to me is interesting too, because he doesn't have the disciples dismiss the crowd here because he is the general. He is the one that's head over the legion. So he's the one that deals with the crowd. But verse 23, after he had dismissed them, he went up on a mountainside by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone, but the boat was already a considerable distance from land, buffeted by the waves because the wind was against it. Remember, we talked about before, why on the Sea of Galilee would professional fishermen miss the fact that there could be a storm coming? Yes, because of the geographical terrain, that the mountains produced very unpredictable weather patterns. So even professional fishermen, especially at night, when they're going out across the Sea of Galilee, it could come up on them at any moment, and they could be caught in quite an awkward situation. Verse 25, during the fourth watch, what time would that be? Yes. During the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went out to them walking on the lake. That's convenient. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. It's a ghost, they said, and cried out in fear. Okay, what does the sea stand for in Jewish minds? Chaos. Evil and chaos. Where do we get that from the Old Testament? It's a popular chapter that we've talked about a lot, considering the Son of Man. Daniel chapter 7. The very first verses of Daniel 7 pictures four beasts. And where do they come from? The sea. Absolutely, they come from the sea. This is also where the beast from Revelation, the first beast from Revelation 13 comes, the sea. This is why in Revelation chapter 4, it says that before the throne, the sea was like crystal, it was like glass. Because evil and chaos was absolutely at peace at the foot of the sovereignty of God at His throne. This is why in Revelation 21:1, it says there was no longer any sea in the new heavens, the new earth, because evil and chaos would be eradicated. They are on the sea, and it lives up to its reputation. But there is a superstition in the ancient world, an omen, especially from sailors, that right before your death, you would see probably some sort of apparition, some sort of ghost. And so they're on the sea, and the evil and chaos is raging. And they look out, and what do they think they see? They think they see a ghost, and they cried out in fear. Why? Because they think they're about to die. Again. But Jesus immediately said to them, "Take courage, it is I. Don't be afraid." Do you know what the Greek for "it is I" is there? Look it up. Anybody have a Greek Bible? Anyone? None? All right. What does that say?
I am.
Go, a me. Why is that significant?
I am.
In Jewish understanding? Say it again.
God.
Yes. Because of Exodus chapter 3, verse 14. When Moses, who is commissioned to go and form the people by bringing them out of the Exodus, and he's saying he's afraid. He's like, how can I possibly go and do this? Who's going to listen to me? Who am I to go to Pharaoh and say, let the people go of Israel? He says, if I go there, what if they ask me, who sent you? Who's the one that sent you to set us free? Who? What am I supposed to say? That the burning bush guy sent me? Is that what I'm supposed to say? And God says, no. If they ask you who sent you, you look at them and you say, tell them I am sent you. Tell them I am who I am sent you. In Jewish tradition, it came to be referenced, ego in me, as I am. This is why in John chapter 8, verse 58, when Jesus says, before Abraham was born, I am, ego in me, they picked up stones to kill him. Why? Not because he was claiming to live before Abraham. They would have just made fun of that because he's a psycho. But whenever he says, before Abraham was born, ego in me, he's saying something that deserves killing. He's saying something that deserves stoning. He's claiming a position, claiming a title that only belongs to the one that spoke from the burning bush. And here, in a moment whenever they are afraid, whenever they are in fear, whenever they're facing evil, when they're facing chaos and they fear, Jesus comes and he doesn't just say, don't be afraid. He also says, ego in me. In chapter 10, verses 26 through 31, Jesus says, don't be afraid three times when he's sending them out to their mission. And why? What is the reasons that he gives that they should not be afraid? Do we remember? Say it again. Yeah. What does he command them to do? He says, fear God. Because, I mean, my word, why are you going to fear the one that can kill your body? Why don't you fear the one that can actually kill your soul? And then he starts talking about sparrows, doesn't he? He's like, sparrows, you can buy two for a penny. And yet every single sparrow that dies is in under the sovereignty of God. And he says, don't you know that even that God numbers the hairs on your head? So don't be afraid on the mission that's going to lead to persecution. You see, Jesus comes and he says, the only one to fear is God. But if God says, don't be afraid, then you have nothing to fear. Right? And it reminds me of the parables in chapter 13, that even in the face of evil and chaos, the kingdom of God is victorious. Don't be afraid. Take courage. It is I, ego in me. Don't be afraid. Lord, if it's you, Peter replied, tell me to come on the water. Come, he said. Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, cried out, Lord, save me. Immediately Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. You of little faith, he said, why did you doubt? This is something we need to deal with because it's similar to what is sometimes abused in verse 58 of chapter 13. And he did not do many miracles there because of their lack of faith. Here's the question. Peter's the one that got out of the boat. Right? There's 11 other cowards that are like, yeah, Peter, go test it out, you know. And Jesus looks at him and says, you have little faith? You have little faith, why do you doubt? He says. My word, you think he'd give him a little bit of, hey, job well done, Peter. Right? Why not? Because Peter's shown that his perspective is the same as those in the boat. How do we define faith? Is it just if we hope and believe and just love Jesus enough with our hearts? No. In Matthew, the definition of faith is the acknowledgement and the submission to the authority of Jesus, even in the face of evil, even in the face of persecution, even in the face of chaos. It's acknowledging that it doesn't matter what happens. It doesn't matter if John is dying. It doesn't matter if Nazareth rejects us. It doesn't matter if we don't have any food in the wilderness. It doesn't even matter if a storm is raging all around us. It doesn't matter. In those moments, we trust in the authority of Jesus. The authority to both save us and the authority to both and the authority to also allow us to die. We trust. This is, again, goes back to the same thing we were talking about yesterday. But ultimately, do you trust God enough to allow Him, to give Him the liberty to allow you to die a slow and painful death? Do you trust Him enough? It's not easy whenever you take it to that level. But ultimately, that's the issue here, is that Peter may be out of the boat, but he's got the same problem. He doesn't trust Jesus' authority to provide for the kingdom to be established in all circumstances. Even in the face of evil, though, the parables say the kingdom of God is victorious. And matter of fact, doubt usually comes, a lot of times doubt is usually fueled by fear. Fear. A lot of times, and usually a lot of times, fear is fueled by the danger of losing control. All of them are together. Doubt and fear are connected because a lot of times doubt is fueled by fear. But a lot of times fear is fueled by the desire of wanting to be in control, but you have to lose control. And that's why they're fearing in verse 26, because the storms come and they can't control it. And their get out of jail free card, the one that was sleeping on their boat the last time, happens to be on the shoreline. Verse 32, and when they climbed into the boat, Jesus and Peter, that is, the wind died down. Then those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, truly you are the Son of God. In two times in this account, we have things that point to Jesus' divinity. He says, go at me, and he accepts worship. Truly you are the Son of God. Son of God would not be pointing to divinity. Hear that? That's kingdom language. When they had crossed over, they landed at Gennesaret. And when the men of that place recognized Jesus, they sent word to all the surrounding country. People brought all their sick to him and begged him to let the sick just touch the edge of his cloak. And all who touched him were healed. What does verse 34 tell us? Verse 34 through 36 tell us. What are some things that are significant about those verses? Number one, the word Gennesaret. We've not been there in Matthew. And yet, what happens? They recognize him, which tells us what? That even though Jesus hasn't been there, the people have been traveling in order to see him, right? And not just the people physically traveling, but what else is traveling? The word about Jesus. How do we know from this passage? What do they want Jesus just to let them do? Touch the edge of his cloak. What does that remind us of? Chapter 9. Yeah. Chapter 9, when a woman was healed just by touching the edge of his cloak. This is showing that the influence of Jesus is starting to spread very far and wide, which prepares us for chapter 15, verse 1, whenever we have Pharisees and teachers of the law coming from Jerusalem. For now, the word is spread even down to the reigning place of David. Yes?
Could the fact that they recognize Jesus and basically everything that happens in chapter 15 be contributed to the two men with demons in the gatherings that Jesus healed, because it says at the bottom that they went all throughout the region, spreading.
Yeah, but Gennesaret and Gadara are actually, if I remember correctly, Gennesaret is at the north side of the Sea of Galilee, and Gadara is at the southeast corner of Sea of Galilee, if I remember correctly. Because I thought the same thing. In Mark, in the Gospel of Mark, I would say yes. In the Gospel of Matthew, it seems to separate it. Why? I don't know. At least that's what I got from my study. If you find something different, by all means, challenge me. I'd rather be right than to be proud. So, any other questions? You're dismissed. Love you guys. Have a good weekend. I will have chapter 15, verses 1 through 20, up online by 5 o'clock today. So you can watch it over the weekend. Next Tuesday, we're starting at 15, verse 21. And if you watch it, submit your notes to me, 3 bonus points. You have until the test in order to accomplish that. Cool? All right.